Hello, friends, and welcome to Through These Doors, a Fame Recording Studios podcast. I'm your host, Rodney Hall, with Fame Recording Studios, where it all started in Muscle Shoals. And together, we'll be digging deep into the history of Fame Recording Studios and the Muscle Shoals sound, with the musicians, engineers, producers, and music insiders that have turned this small town into a music landmark known around the world. Welcome. Let's get it on.
All right. Today's special guest on Through These Doors is Mr. Harvey Mason Jr. We're very excited to have Harvey here today. And thank you for being here, Harvey.
You kidding, Ronnie? This is amazing. Thank you for letting me through these doors.
Absolutely. So Harvey has penned and produced songs for music industry legends, including Aretha Franklin, Michael Jackson, Justin Timberlake, Whitney Houston, Britney Spears, and Chris Brown. He's also produced music for Blockbuster Musical Productions with Beyonce, Jennifer Hudson, and Dreamgirls, Dr. Dre, and Ice Cube, and Straight Outta Compton, to the eclectic cast in Pitch Perfect, and Mary J. Blige and Neo in The Wiz Live. And more recently, he's been working on a project that's near and dear to our heart, the Aretha Franklin biopic, Respect, which will be coming to theaters in August of 2021, looks like, after much anticipation.
Yeah. Please, theaters, come on.
How many albums have you had?
Four.
And no hits. Honey, find the songs that move you. Until you do that, you ain't going nowhere.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Sing, can't see me.
Aretha, you do talk, don't you? Not just sing.
I like you to call me Miss Franklin.
To disturb the peace when you can't get no peace.
R-E-S-P-E-C-T. Find out what it means to me.
Yeah. Harvey's also the interim CEO of the Recording Academy, which runs the Grammy Awards and many other projects, including the awesome organization Music That Cares. So thank you for being here again, Harvey.
It's a pleasure, Rodney. Thank you. Thank you so much. This is great to have here. So many good people have come through your doors, virtually and literally. So I'm honored to be added to the list. So thank you.
Absolutely. I look forward to after the COVID situation's over, getting you down here in person and maybe doing some work together. That'd be awesome.
Oh my gosh, dream come true. It'd be amazing.
Yeah. So Harvey and I have something in common that I want to start out with, and that is that we have. Both have legendary fathers that were in the music business. So Harvey's dad was a legendary drummer, one of the greats of all time, played with Barbara Streisand, James Brown, Herbie Hancock, Beyonce, Christina Aguilera, Usher, Jennifer Hudson, Frank Sinatra, Ray Charles, just to name a few. So what was that like, Harvey, growing up? I would be interested to know, coming from my perspective, as to what your world was like growing up. I know what mine was like. Were you surrounded by music in your childhood?
Yeah, I really was. And it's probably very comparable to your situation. You know, I grew up going to the studio with my dad. Every spare minute I had was, you know, spent trying to trail him and just grab his coattail, like, take me to work with you and go to sessions. At that point, when I was young, my dad was a songwriter and a producer, but he was also, you know, a heavily working session drummer. So he was going from studio to studio doing films and TV and record dates and jingles for commercials. So I would just hang out with him. And I remember every summer I would fall asleep in the studio and I'd wake up at, you know, 2 or 3 in the morning, we'd go home. And then the next day I'd do the same thing. And I was growing up around the greatest musicians in the world. You know, we were spending time with, you know, Quincy Jones and his camp at that time, making all those great Michael Jackson records and, you know, other records that he was producing. And then, as you said, you know, there'd be a session with like a James Brown or a Barbara Streisand, something like that. So it was an interesting way to come into the business because my expectation level was so high and my bar was set so high that I just thought like that was the level of expertise you had to have to be a professional. So I'm really thankful that I came up with that because it wasn't about being average or ordinary. It was always extraordinary performances and extraordinary musicianship. And the top of every craft, engineers were the best. The arrangers were the best. And so for me, I was just so lucky to grow up around that.
Absolutely. So did you get to spend much time with Quincy? I mean, he's one of my idols and I've gotten to meet him a couple of times. And what was that like just being around? I mean, he's the man.
Yeah. One of my mentors and someone who's impacted my career, just from the standpoint of, you know, the amount of respect that I have for how he's handled his business, conducted himself, and he's been able to work for so long in so many different areas of music. That's something that I really looked up to. I did get to spend a lot of time with him. My dad was one of the drummers, fortunately, that Quincy used quite often in that period in the 70s and 80s and beyond. But I, you know, going to his house for rehearsals, or I was friends with his kids who are all now kind of doing cool things as well. And I've continued my relationship with Quincy, thankfully. Still call him when I have a problem, still call him when I need his insight. And also through the Academy, I've been able to really lean on Quincy to help us with the Academy and some of the initiatives that we're working on. So I'm so, so thankful and lucky to have been introduced to him early. Yeah.
What a treasure. What a treasure he is. So yeah. Did your dad, my father was, he really didn't want us to be in the music business unless we couldn't live without it. So he kind of made it, made it tougher than others. Did your father want you to be in the music business, or did he have preference?
I didn't get the feeling that he cared what I did. I just know that he made it clear that whatever I was going to do, I had to be really good at it. And that was, you know, an expressed perspective from him directly and indirectly, because I saw him work so hard at his craft. I remember him practicing and staying up late and working for days on end. And then I also saw just in his life and the way he did things, if he was going to work out or if he was going to get into exercise or running, he would run every day, like 5 a.m. I'm going to run. So the philosophy at my house was just choose whatever makes you happy, whatever you love to do and whatever you're passionate about, and then go all the way after it and go all the way in and be the best you can be at it. So when I chose music, I think he was happy and he was very supportive and helpful, but he also told me, like, this is not a joke. This is not easy. It's probably the most competitive job you'll ever have. You know, it's millions of people want to be in the music business and a few hundred get in. So that was the way he framed it for me.
Yeah, I think we have that in common as well. My dad was very much he had to say, if you're going to do a job, do it well or don't do it at all. And I was watching Quincy's documentary recently, and I saw him say the exact same quote my dad said. And I was like, no way, that's so bizarre. But it's, you know, it tells you where, you know, what's important. That's a work ethic, you know. So you started out.
Another good quote for you, Rodney. So I talk a lot about the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And so it's similar to Quincy or your dad's quote. It's just, if you're going to do something, you go hard, you go all the way in, and that's going to extend across and be a habit for you in the way you do your business, the way you do your life. And so that's kind of something that I learned along the way, and I like to share every now and then.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So you started out doing jingles. My dad started out doing jingles in the early days, and that's how he ended up being the engineer producer, you know?
Yeah, I did. I was always writing songs, but ended up going to school to play basketball, and that's a whole other story for another day, I'm sure. But I got into writing jingles because I was living in Arizona. I just finished college, finished playing sports, trying to figure out what I was going to do next with my life. Knew I loved music. I knew I had some kind of talent for writing music. And I started writing jingles for local, you know, burger stands and break stores. And I worked my way up through that from in Tucson to doing national commercials for Coca-Cola and Mattel Toys and other things like that. I was really just using it as practice for writing songs and also a way to make money so that I could save enough money to go to LA. And so my goal was I need some equipment to be able to make really competitive records and I need to be in LA. And at that time I was just finishing college in Tucson and really didn't have a way to go to LA. So I wrote a lot of jingles. I remember I got my first check, I think it was $1,000 or $1,500. I was like, this is amazing. I'm going to make money writing music. And so that's how I got started.
Yeah. What was some of your first gear?
During that period, my first gear was, I was saving up to buy an MPC 60, which is an Akai, you know, drum machine / sequencer. I saved up to buy a Kurzweil K2000. Then that graduated to a Korg M1. Kind of went through that process. But before that, I got to be honest, and now I'm dating myself, I started programming and writing songs on an Oberheim OBX system, which is like CB gate. That was before MIDI. And then luckily my dad went to Japan on a tour one year and brought home a Yamaha DX7, which was our first MIDI keyboard. Oh, yeah. You could connect stuff together. I was like, oh, this is game changing. So I've been all through all of it.
Absolutely. So what would you consider your first really big break in music? Obviously you had your basketball career before that. But.
Yeah. My first big break came when I was too young to appreciate it as a big break. I was 10 years old and I wrote a song that my dad took to a session and Grover Washington Jr. ended up cutting it on his record. So that was the first time I made money as a professional music. But then my next big break that I actually said, whoa, this is a big break, was an A&R person in LA heard some of my music. I was still living in Tucson, still doing jingles, driving back and forth, trying to pitch my cassettes to people. And one guy heard one of my cassettes and sat me down, gave me a long conversation, told me some things I needed to work on. I went home, came back, presented him some songs that I had written. He said, okay, you listened, you learned, I like what you did, I'm going to give you a job. And he also gave me a check for, I think, $1,500 to do a song for a group on Motown. And that was my big break to kind of get me initially in the door to the industry. The thing that brought me a lot of success shortly thereafter was a song that I wrote for an artist named Brandy. That song became, you know, a successful song on her record that ended up selling, I don't know, 10 million records, something like that. And from that point, I established a reputation as a good songwriter and producer. So those are probably a couple moments.
So when did you say, well, I think music's going to be what I'm going to do for the rest of my life? Or have you said that yet?
You know, I'm trying to remember back when I graduated from you know, playing sports and started writing songs. I think at that point I said, I love this. This is what I really want to do. I was not certain that I was going to be able to make a living at it until I had a couple of those breaks. So I think it probably happened around that time when people started noticing what I was doing and appreciating it. And then, you know, ultimately paying me for it. And at that point I was like, okay, I'm in. This is what I want to do. I love it. It brings me so much satisfaction. It's challenging. It's hard. It's very competitive. You know, I like the competitive nature of it. Somehow that kind of suited my personality. And I know that's not very artistic leaning, but I like trying to beat other people and make sure.
We're very competitive down here.
Very competitive. So that's probably when it hit me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So Rodney Jerkins was instrumental in your career. Yep. Tell me about that and about mentorship and how important it is to young musicians and you know, how a young musician can go about finding someone to mentor them.
Well, don't have anyone named Rodney mentoring you, that's for sure. No, just kidding. So it was a weird dynamic with Rodney Jerkins because he obviously was like supremely talented, an amazing songwriter, great musician, producer, hustler, you know, all around good guy. But he was considerably younger than I was. And I was already writing music and making songs and produced records. So when we got together, it was, you know, he was obviously much more successful than me. So I'm not trying to pretend like I, you know, taught him anything or helped him any way. But it was an interesting dynamic because I had accomplished certain things. But getting the opportunity to work with Rodney, I was exposed to artists that I would have never worked with up until that point. I got to see his style of production and the way he worked. And he was a very, you know, hard worker, very talented. So I think I did get so much value from that experience. I worked with him for 2 years. I think if there's a mentor for me, it was, first of all, my father and watching how he worked, probably similar to you. And then Quincy, although we didn't spend a lot of time in the studio, I was around the studio quite a few times where he was there working. So I got to watch that. And then a man named Clive Davis, who you probably know was the head of Arista Records and then ultimately J Records, now at Sony. He was somebody that I started working with very early in my career. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he, for some reason, liked me. I have no idea why, and just took a liking to my music and started spending a lot of time critiquing and teaching and showing me the ways of the industry. And he's still someone I call a really good friend, and similar to Quincy, someone that I call when I have issues or a question or I'm trying to work out a problem. So I was very lucky to have those as mentors. And I've mentioned one other person, my college basketball coach, Lute Olson, which doesn't really apply to, you know, what we're talking about. But in life, he was a mentor because very much like both of our fathers, the bar of expectation was so high because I had spent time around Coach Olson. He did the same thing for me. He was like, okay, great. You think you're really good at whatever it is, X, Y, or Z, but I expect you to be here. And that really carried over into my music and into my life. So I can't talk about mentors without mentioning Lute Olson.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Coming from Alabama, we get that. You know, we had Bear Bryant. Now we got Nick Saban that everybody has to live up to and live with.
Right. That's a little different, but yeah, I hear you.
So tell me about your studio. Is it a commercial facility, or do you rent it out, or is it just for your work?
It's just for my work. You know, if there are people that need to do a session or need help with something and I have a relationship with them, yes, I will let them rent the studio. But it is so busy, to be honest. Thankfully, we have probably seven or eight different rooms kind of all going at the same time. We have one big room that you can do strings and scoring sessions. It can hold 80 piece orchestra with four isolation booths, big control room. And that studio is kind of cranking pretty much every day of the week, thankfully. Not for rent, but it's a commercial type facility.
Right. Sure. What kind of consoles you got?
You know, it's funny. We're expecting delivery on a console in 10 days. We just ordered a new SSL Duality, which is kind of a combo digital analog console. We had a vintage Neve, which we have in the other room. And then I have a couple small format consoles in other studios. But the big main room now, as of December 14th, will be the new Duality.
Excellent. Yeah, I look forward to hearing how you like that. Yeah, we've got an SSL in one room and a Neve in the other. So we've.
What's your Neve that you have?
We have an 8232. And then the SSL is a 6000E.
Yeah.
We just put it in a year ago, I guess, right before COVID. Perfect timing.
Yeah, we'll be ready for when we break.
Yeah, absolutely. So, say you decide to work with an artist. Can you tell me about your production process and what happens from there, what the next steps are?
A lot of my process goes on before we even play any music. It's really talking and learning about the artist and figuring out where they are in their journey and in their career, what's going on in their life. I really believe strongly that music is performed by artists that it resonates with or is relevant to their life. So you can write any kind of random generic song and then have a singer sing it, but if it really is applicable to their life and they're feeling it, then the emotion and the just pure rawness of the lyrics that they're singing comes out in the performance. So I like to make sure we're writing songs that are specific to the artist and to their needs. Once we understand what that is, of course, you're taking in all the other stakeholders. You got the A&R people and the label executives and all the people's handlers. You know, everybody's got a PR person and a manager. Yeah. So you try and cut through all that and really balance it and decipher where we headed. Once you figure that out, then for me, it's really about sitting at the piano and really trying to catch a feel for what type of song you're going to make. You know, if the artist is going through something emotional, then it's obviously going to be a little bit more of a slow song, maybe a ballad or a mid-tempo. If they're like riding high or they're angry or they're coming off a relationship and all they want to do is go out, then you're doing an up-tempo song. So you're creating the music that fits the mood of the conversation you just had. Then the next step is to get together with the top liners or the writers. I do top line as well, but you know, we'll usually collaborate with somebody else and the artist. And we all sit in the room based off the music you made, based off the conversation you had, and you try and put it all together in a story. And then you record it. And sometimes artists will come with a story and say, you know, I've been thinking about this. This is what's going on in my life. Here's a couple of lines that I've jotted down. And you'll try and take that. So as a producer and a songwriter, and you know this, it's like, it's almost like a coach or someone who has to pull things from all different people, and you have to get the best out of people. Some of them are at this level, some are at that level, but you have to figure out how to put all the pieces together. So that's really one of the things I consider the biggest challenges of my job, is figuring out, no two cases are the same. So you're figuring out, where are we? Where are we trying to get? How do we get there?
Right. You know, I think one of my dad's talents, and one that hopefully he's passed down to me, is finding talent and recognizing talent in the raw, in the rough. Mm-hmm. When you're looking for that, when you're looking for that next artist, what are you looking for, and how is that, as you've gained experience over the years, how has that changed?
I think it's changed in the sense that we used to be so caught up in worrying about who was going to be the next star. And like, did they have the it factor? Did they have the look? Could they dance? What kind of videos did they make? And now that kind of translates to how many, you know, Instagram followers do they have, or what's their social media brand? And then as I evolved, I started going more away from that and more towards what really hits me in the heart. Like, what type of artistry affects me in a visceral or an emotional way? Like, what is it that moves me, and what do I love, and who do I believe that performs? And those are the type of artists that I try and sign, but more importantly, those are the artists I try and work with and just connect myself to, because those are the ones that are so meaningful in the long run, and the ones that I think more people buy into and associate with, and I find are just more gratifying to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've done a lot of different things in the entertainment business: jingles, songwriting, production, film. So is that by design, or did that just happen?
I think it's by design. I like to think it's by design. I just had a wide variety of interests, things that I like to do. And maybe I got that from being around people like Quincy or my dad, and seeing how they were able to use their talents for other things and be able to experiment. And if they saw something they liked, they'd be like, oh, I want to go over there and try that. And right. So it was the way I built my company. And one of the reasons it's not called, you know, productions or records or publishing, it's like, it's a lot of things that I want to try and do in my business. Right. And I really enjoy the different challenges. And I think each one takes a different skill set and mentality. And I think that's what keeps it fresh for me. And it's why I'm so excited and just rejuvenated every day.
I hear you. I've always thought one of the reasons that we've had the longevity we've had, being around 60 years, is that my dad was very good at diversifying and doing a lot of different things, being a publisher, being a songwriter, being an engineer, producer, studio owner, you know, and just doing a little bit of all of it. And that's the advice that we give to young musicians. It's like, you know what, learn as much as you can, because they're all tools, and some you'll use more than others, but, you know, you'll have that knowledge.
Such good information. And your dad is a consummate, like, well-rounded music man. And I've definitely respected that about how you guys have done that over the years.
Yeah. So what do you think are the major differences between making music for film and just making music for an album?
I'm trying to think of a really clever analogy, but the differences are pretty stark. When you're making an album, you're making it for yourself and maybe the artist, and you're doing whatever in the heck you think is cool to you. And if your personal tastes happen to align with the tastes of the general public, you'll have a hit. If what you like is not like what is hitting everybody else, then you probably won't have a very successful record. You make a song in a vacuum, and you and the people that you wrote it with will love it, but that's about it. So it's really determined on your tastes. When you're making music for film and television, it's not that you're selling out, or it's not that you're worrying about what everybody else thinks. It's just a function of that job. You have to be considerate of the direct director and their tastes. You have to think about the producers. You have to think about the studio. You have to think about the head of music. You also have to think, and this is probably the most important, you have to think about the script and what this piece of music is doing in the story and how is it serving the film? How is it furthering the script? How is it tied into the emotion or progression of one of the characters? Those are all things that you have to consider when you're creating music that you're not even close to thinking about when you're just writing a record. So it's a different, it's more of a cerebral process and a lot more to consider.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never done any film work. So it seems daunting to say the least, because I know what it's like to deal with the A&R and record labels and, you start bringing in music supervisors and all this.
Another one. I didn't mention that layer of music supervisors, music coordinators. It's a lot.
Yeah, it really is. So in your mind, what makes a great record producer?
I think a great record producer obviously starts by being a good musician. And I'm not saying you have to be a virtuoso at any one in particular instrument, but you have to have good ears. You have to know about music, and you also have to understand the history of music. I don't think producers that come in and just say, I don't care what's happened before me, I'm not a huge fan of that. I think doing your homework and studying and being respectful of music in general and being well-rounded is really important. I think one of the most critical parts about being a producer is managing people and dealing with, and as you said, your dad was great at this, dealing with finding out who can do what and knowing how to put those pieces together.
Exactly.
It's a lot like, finishing a puzzle with all these pieces on the table. Some people just try and jam them in and hope that it looks nice, or you can really take the time to put them together nicely and create a really beautiful picture. And I think being a good producer means understanding the personalities, understanding how to motivate, understanding how to collaborate and how to put things together to make a finished product.
Yeah. So you're now the interim CEO of the Recording Academy, which runs the Grammys and Music Cares, as I mentioned earlier. Tell us what that job entails, because that as well seems like a daunting task in these days. Although in these days, I think it is the Recording Academy is more important than it's ever been.
I agree, and that's why I wanted to do the job, because it's definitely daunting. It's not, I didn't choose to do it for the glory of it, that's for sure. I think there's a lot of work that needed to be done with the Academy, and I did feel it was important. I've been involved with the Academy for 10 or 15 years, and I was just a firm believer in the mission and the things that the Academy did, giving back to the music community. I mean, I came up in this music community, so I saw what the Academy was doing, and you mentioned Music Cares, helping people who need help, helping people who've lost their instruments, who are sick, who need to pay their rent. And then through the Grammy Museum, so preserving music and the history of music, but also putting music in schools and teaching the next generation of music makers, what a violin is, because how else are they going to know that? A lot of schools don't have music instruments. And then our advocacy efforts in D.C., making sure that music people are able to make a living and can monetize their art and intellectual property is protected. And the things that the Academy is doing in DC was so, so important, especially now in times of streaming. So when I saw those things happening, and then I saw so much criticism coming down towards the Academy, I felt the time was right to try and make some of the changes that needed to be made and also start telling the story and do some education and some amplification around what goes on behind the Academy doors, not just on Grammy night, but the rest of the year, the 364 days of the year. So we've made some pretty drastic changes. We've really evolved a lot of our programs. Very proud of the work that the team has done and the staff and the members. We represent over 25,000 members, and we take that very, very seriously. Very proud of the work that's being done, but we also realize that there's a lot more to do, which is, to your point, all very daunting.
Yeah. It's such a great organization, and I've watched it my whole life. When I was a kid, my dad was nominated for Producer of the Year in 1975. Mm-hmm. It was the very first year they gave Producer of the Year, and he was nominated. I was telling my friend Dave Cobb, who's nominated this year, his one of his best friends from high school was a guy named Billy Sherrill, who went on to be a huge producer in Nashville and did George Jones and Tammy Wynette. And they were both nominated for producer of the year. They went to a high school that had about 300 people in the whole high school.
They're both nominated.
The very first year with Stevie Wonder, Lenny Warnker, and Tom Bell. Tom Bell won. So
amazing. That's history right there.
Yeah, it's pretty. That was a fact that my dad loved to tell people that he was on nominated for the first year the award was ever given. Cool. So the Grammys are set for January, right?
Yeah, January 31st.
So what changes have been made due to COVID?
Everything. You know, we've literally everything. Only thing that hasn't changed is the date so far. We'll see. But you know, there's not going to be an audience. We can't do audiences right now in LA. We're going to still have performances live, you know, awards, the whole deal. We're going to do something that I don't think anyone has seen yet. We're definitely going out of our way to make sure that this awards show is a huge event and a spectacle. And the main reason we're doing it is because we see it as an opportunity to really bring people together and unite. And, you know, it's been a dang hard year, and it's been so much ups and downs, mostly downs with COVID and just the social and racial unrest that's happening and the financial insecurity that's been going on. And now with January starting a new year, I think we'll have the inauguration just a few days before. I feel like there's hopefully going to be a renewed sense of hope and togetherness. And we want to use this celebration as a platform to unite and bring people together and to start to heal some of the things that have happened. And music has done that in the past. So for us at the Academy, we're trying to make this as special as possible, as meaningful as possible in a time when we really think that there's a need for it.
Yeah, oh, we certainly do. The country needs to be healed. For sure. So let's talk about Respect, Aretha's movie. So you are one of the producers on Respect, with just an all-star list of directors and producers and writers. And I went over, several of us from Muscle Shoals went over and saw him shoot the Muscle Shoals scene, which was great to see. So tell me how involved Aretha was in the whole process before she passed.
She was very involved. It was early, it was before we started production or writing for that matter, but she was involved in telling me the stories that she wanted to have told, what the perspective was, some of the song choices, some of the things she didn't want to talk about. We talked a lot about having Jennifer play her, and she was adamant about that. And so that was something I was pleased that she got to weigh in on. And she passed just before we had hired a director and a screenwriter. But I passed along all the information that I had gotten from talking with Aretha. And we had been developing this film for about, I'd say, 3 years before she passed away. So I have, you know, a lot of notes, a lot of stories, and just a lot of memories that she shared with me. And I'd been working with Aretha on her music for, I think, 13 or 14 years. That's how I originally got to know Aretha. And I think that's why she trusted me with her life story, is because of the time we spent together in the studio. And you know how that goes. You're in the studio with long hours, and there's that relationship that gets built. Mm-hmm. And so she was very involved, and we took her involvement very seriously. And that was one of the things that I talked to her about, it feels uncomfortable to say it, but I did say, I said, Aretha, this is our chance to tell the story that you think needs to be told. It's an amazing tale. It's the story of someone who becomes the biggest singer of our time at that period and has the biggest voice of our time, but who in their life really had no voice and had no say and no control over their own destiny. And so I just thought it was a time for the story to come out. And I felt having Aretha involved in it was so, so important. So I was really happy and fortunate that she was a believer in me and in the project and worked so closely with us. And I hope that we make her proud with the end result.
I feel you will. That's amazing that she got to be involved in it. And I hope there's some kind of behind the scenes documentary that comes out about the whole process one day. Wow. So why do you, what, why was recording at Fame such an important chapter in the Aretha story? And I would love to hear what her perspective of that was. You know, we never got to hear her talk a lot about Muscle Shoals because it ended not well. it ended great and that she got her first two hit records, but you know the story.
That's a little bit, you know, how she always talked about it was mixed emotions and bittersweet, because it was an introduction for her to a different way of working, a different style of recording. And it's no secret, not giving away any you know, hidden bonuses of the movie. Previous to being at Muscle Shoals, she made a lot of records with very limited success. She was recording some standards and some jazz and some other styles of music with great producers and great label, but it just didn't quite jive with where she was vocally and with her as a career. So between your dad and Jerry Wexler, they had this different style of working, and, you know, attributed to your pop and the musicians and the whole Muscle Shoals thing. But she went down there and really found herself, and she started to find her footing as an artist, and the style in which your father recorded her and integrated her into his system and his musicians gave for her the first jolt of, you know, confidence and also first bit of success. So it was a critical role in her career and development and ultimate progression to becoming who she was.
Yeah.
Without that stop, it wouldn't have happened, period.
Yeah, well, we're very honored to be involved at all, even if there was a fight involved.
Yeah, well, it all happened for a reason.
Yeah.
I didn't seem like that at the time, but it all plays out well. And that's one of the best scenes in the movie, by the way. Your dad is great. Love it.
That,
be happy.
I could tell you, I was, you know, I don't even know if I was born, but it was the year I was born. And I don't know, just talking to him, I've talked to my mom about it recently, and my dad, you're talking about being upset over a situation, because at that point, Aretha was an artist that hadn't had any hits. So he was, you know, really concerned about losing his relationship with Wexler and Atlantic Records. So I know she said he during that time, she would go to church. My dad would be on the phone with Wexler. She'd get out of church 2 or 3 hours later, come home, and he'd still be on the phone with him. Yeah. So it was a trying time for them all. But so you played basketball at the University of Arizona and had a scholarship, played in the Final Four in 1998 with teammates Sean Elliott, Steve Kerr. So how did that experience as a basketball player impact your career as a musician and producer?
Well, that was everything, you know, impacted every part of my life. And I wish we played 98 Final Four. It was actually 88 Final Four. So I'm slightly older than you're making me sound. But so 88 Final Four. And it was a great experience playing in the Final Four, but it was the worst experience because we lost and we should have won. So that always pisses me off. And I always try and back that up. But playing with those types of players, and it goes to the theme of, you know, what we've been talking a lot about, just my level of expectation and the bar of excellence was set so high playing with other players like that. You know, coming out of high school, I was an All-American player and led the state scoring and did all these great things. And then I got to Arizona and I was like, oh man, these guys are amazing. I got to step up my entire game, my work ethic, everything has to improve if I'm going to be competitive at this level. So that really set the tone for me in everything that I've done since then, because two things happened. Number one, I never enter into a situation complacent. I never come into a situation thinking that I'm ready for it or that I'm good enough to be there. And the second thing that I got from it was you have to be the hardest worker involved. You have to work harder than all your competition. If you want to even compete, you have to work harder than everybody. And so I've just taken those two things: come in prepared, work hard before you get there, and then when you get in the position or you get the opportunity, outwork everybody else. And those are things that I got from, you know, Steve Kerr, Sean Elliott, and my coach Lute Olson, among other players that I played with there. And it's really helped me in, you know, just life, my relationship, my business, music producing, songwriting, anything that I've tried to do, even working at the academy. You know, I come into the academy very humble, with big ears, you know, literally and figuratively just listening, learning, trying to get better, trying to bring what I can bring to the team, like I was at Arizona, I bring what I can bring, but also understanding like you are not the best person in the world at anything you're doing. There's always people better. There's always people you can learn from and grow from. And so that's had a huge impact. And then as we talked about earlier, being competitive and not wanting to lose, you know, I had the fortune of playing on that team. We were ranked number one, I don't know, probably 60 or 70 weeks through my 4 year time there. So we were a highly regarded, highly ranked team throughout my career. And we took that very seriously. And every time we went on the floor, we wanted to demolish the competition. We didn't want to win by 10 or 20. We wanted to win by 30. And so I really think that carried over, which is not something commonly found in the arts or in music, you know, trying to beat somebody up, and musically speaking. Yeah. So I think it had a big impact on my life.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my dad, one of his sayings to everyone that he ever worked with was, if I work 18 hours a day and my competition works 8 hours a day, I'll eat their lunch in half the time.
I love that. That is good.
And he lived it. There was no one going to outwork him. I promise you that. You know, and sometimes you'd be on mix 125, and he'd say, "Okay, make cassette copies of those six mixes and come in the next day and go, we don't have it." Right. And then, you know, a few days later, go back. Well, you know what? I was listening to mix 3. That one was. I think that's it.
Wow. You know. I wish I had gotten the chance to know your dad. I'm thankful that I got to meet you and know you and hang with you a bit. But people like that are inspirational to me. They really are. And that's how Quincy is. And, you know, I worked on Michael Jackson's last record. I don't remember what year it was. It's probably 2000 or somewhere around there. And he's very much the same way. He does not sleep. He does not stop working. And he would say to me, he'd say, "Harvey, you know, I cut a vocal 6 months ago. It was Thursday, January 21st. I think it was on the second verse on the 14th track. I did this little run there. Can you go back and pull that and put it in the comp that we're doing now?" And I'd be like, "You're crazy. There's no chance that you can remember that." And I would go back to the tapes. I'd look on track 14, the second verse, and there's this run. And I'd be like, "I don't understand how people can just grind so hard and do so many different passes and so many different attempts to make things perfect and put it all together." And I think your dad probably had that. Michael has that. Quincy has that. And other people that I really respect have that. So something to it.
Yeah. You know, when the recently in the last, I don't know, in the last 10 years anyway, that's recent to me, a special edition Thriller album came out, CD. And there's a version of Billie Jean. It's a demo of him just kind of, he doesn't even have the lyrics yet, but you can just hear the brilliance and how much that record was him. And it wasn't, you know, some producer coming in and say, "Sing on this." It was, right. It's completely Michael. And just, it gives me chills to listen to it because it's just a
special talent.
Absolutely. Well, Harvey, we sure appreciate you coming on the show today. And, it's been awesome talking to you, and I look forward to working with you in the future. And I hope you have a great holidays, and thank you again.
Well, Rodney, thank you so much. And I can't go without saying thank you to your entire family, to what you guys have done for music in general. I mean, none of what I make would be being made if it wasn't for your family and your father and his legacy and the sounds that came into my ears and then out of my fingers. So it's an honor to talk to you, honor to be in on your podcast or your show and to come through these doors. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you. Have a great week.